Like most Americans, I don't believe that students should be treated differently based on their race.
In the winter of 2015, Abigail Fisher spoke outside the U.S. Supreme Court. Fisher was at the center of the most prominent college admissions case to reach the Supreme Court in a very long time. Fisher v. University of Texas.
Hopefully, this case will end racial classifications and preferences in admissions at the University of Texas.
Fisher is white, and when she applied to UT Austin in 2008, she was denied admission. Her lawyers argued that this decision had everything to do with race.
Well, that's what we're seeking in this case, Mr. Chief Justice, a level playing field for Abby Fisher.
The Supreme Court first heard Fisher's case in 2012 and then again in 2016. Both times they ruled that affirmative action is constitutional as long as colleges adhere to a set of guidelines when using race as a factor in admissions.
In order for judicial review to be meaningful, a university must make a showing that its plan is narrowly tailored to achieve the only interest that this court has approved in this context.
Anthony Kennedy delivered the court's majority opinion back in 2013.
The benefits of a student body diversity that encompasses a broad array of qualifications and characteristics of which racial or ethnic origin is but a single, though important, element.
When the court upheld its decision 3 years later, then-President Barack Obama voiced his support.
I'm pleased that the Supreme Court upheld the basic notion that diversity is an important value in our society, and that this country should provide a high-quality education to all our young people, regardless of their background.
But today, there are signs of shifting attitudes about the use of race-based affirmative action. Earlier this month, the Education and Justice Departments withdrew several Obama-era guidances that support affirmative action. And in a lawsuit expected to go to trial this fall, a group of Asian American students rejected from Harvard are alleging that the university's admissions policies unfairly disadvantaged Asian American students on the whole, while giving a leg up to other minority groups. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today, a look at how affirmative action works and whether or not it can survive.
One of the greatest tragedies in this country is to attack the only systemic remedy that we have to stimulate racial equity and racial diversity.
That's Glenn Singleton, a former director of Western Regional Admissions for the University of Pennsylvania.
Affirmative action has had extraordinary value, and I would not be sitting here with you if there weren't an affirmative action process.
Today, Glenn runs Courageous Conversations, an organization that consults with companies about racial equity, including our co-producer, WNYC. And he described how the admissions process works.
We would literally spend all day as the admissions staff reading applications. And our applications are quite comprehensive. We do a holistic look. So it's not only a look at their scores and grades and things like that, but the applicants write essays. They have recommendations. All of that's taken into account. Ultimately, we go to committee. And in that committee, the director will present the applicant and we'll talk about the applicant's qualifications. And as a committee, we'll decide whether that applicant moves into one of three categories. That applicant would be admitted. That applicant would be waitlisted, meaning that we would figure out over the course of the period whether we're going to admit that student or not, or the applicant would be denied admission.
Can you give us a sense for how and when race factored in, and if race factored into the admissions process when you were a part of it?
Absolutely. The race does factor into the admission process. We recognize that in order to bring a racially diverse class to an institution that has a history of not bringing racially diverse classes, we have to be affirmative in that process. We are affirmative in many components of the class, though, I should say. So oftentimes there's a lot of pressure around the race aspect of affirmative action. But to sort of see that children whose parents went to the institution bring value to the institution, to see that admitting students who come from families that have enormous resources to provide to the institution, they bring some kind of dimension to the class, to see that a faculty staff children, you know, who are professors at the institution, their students are looked at in an affirmative way as well. Athletes are looked at in an affirmative way. And each of these groups of students are believed to contribute some dimension to the class.
When we hone in on race as the problem, and I think that's what we'll, you know, we see a lot of that playing out in people's discomfort with race-based affirmative action, rarely do we put the same lens on the majority white students who benefit from legacy admissions. Are legacies even fair?
I mean, the word fair is probably the most interesting word that you're using, right? Because what's fair here? I'm not sure that as an admissions director, I was looking for what's fair. What I was looking for was what is going to bring about the best learning experience for the students who come to the University of Pennsylvania. And as an African-American male who went to Penn and found myself having to often teach my white friends and faculty what it means to not only navigate the university, but many experiences that are racially loaded, this part and contribution, I believe, is quite necessary. And so I can very easily explain why we need to diversify by race. When I look at the legacy factor, okay, sometimes I can't explain that. But what I do know is that when the institution is generous to the sons and daughters of its alumni, then those alumni tend to be more generous to the institution.
One of the issues that has come up is there's been an argument in favor of class-based affirmative action, if you will, and it's a complicated topic. But just in terms of what you're saying, if that lens shifts to focusing on lower-income student admissions, for example, will they be valued as much as the ones that you're describing who literally bring money to the table?
Yeah, it's quite predictable in this country that there is this debate between race and class. And I find that telling because there is a difference in being poor and black in the United States and being poor and white. And both of those poor students will bring an understanding about poverty. What is the distinction is that that poor student of color can not only speak to navigating to excellence, which is where we've admitted that student because of their economic circumstances, but they can also talk about how those dynamics of systemic institutional racism in our society have also been barriers for them that they've been somehow able to navigate and still show excellence.
I want to go back to the case of Abigail Fisher in Texas. And that case has now been settled. But part of what Abigail Fisher and many other people who take issue with affirmative action, there's a sense that their spots have been taken because of affirmative action, that
right.
Their rightful seat at the table, if you will, has been taken away from them in favor of an, and I will, undeserving, quote unquote, black or brown student.
Correct. And so, you know, as a former admissions director, my heart goes out to all students whose dreams are shattered when they're not admitted, right? And I had this conversation on national television about the problem of particularly white parents not preparing their students for the reality that there is no spot that is their spot. Okay? And this process, by definition, is a selective process. And selective means that you can have qualification, which means you're eligible, but you might not be selected. Okay, and so I think the nation has to reflect on the fact that millions of students are denied admission every year. Abigail Fisher never had a spot at the University of Texas, and that's where the breakdown was, right? So no one took her spot. No one takes anyone's spot. Those spots have to be allocated to the most diverse class that will get at the challenges facing the country, facing the state of Texas, facing the communities. And so how we find people who actually bring that kind of understanding and bring that kind of ability to do the work. And I don't believe that by and large we're admitting anybody who's not ready to do the work. The question is, can they navigate the environment, including a whole lot of people at the institution who believe that they shouldn't be there?
If affirmative action is ruled unconstitutional, what would you see being the biggest change?
This is such a complex thing that I feel the United States is trying to move to a Supreme Court decision when in reality, we need to allow this to be a part of the dialogue and the conversation right now. And we need to allow for people to dig into this and really make meaning of it. And if in fact the Supreme Court rules affirmative action illegal, then I know that as an admissions director then, and as I could picture myself in that seat today, I'm still going to be able to figure out how to diversify my class.
Glenn Singleton is the founder of Courageous Conversations and former director of Western Regional Admissions for the University of Pennsylvania. Glenn, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So what do students think about the affirmative action policies that could affect their chances of getting into their dream school? I asked three of them. Diana Brown is going into her senior year at Cornell.
I think when I was applying, what made my application stand out, aside from basic things like having the right test scores and having performed decently well in high school, was at the time the college that I'm in, which I'm in the hotel program at Cornell, required in-person interviews. And so I do think that kind of made my application stand out. I'm also a legacy within my school. Just my mom attended the school before me. So I don't know the degree to which that is considered. Obviously, like, the process isn't completely transparent, but that was kind of part of my process of applying, was putting down that I was a legacy.
Bernita Haynes is a lawyer who graduated from Drury University in 2006 and the University of Iowa Law School in 2013.
I was one of three African-American students entering into my freshman class in 2002 at Drury University. That alone kind of confirmed for me that being African-American had a lot of impact on my acceptance. I also, in my essay for admission to Drury University, I remember speaking about being from an African-American family, from a poor family, a single-parent family, and how that had impacted my decision to want to go to college. That's something I've always owned and been very eager to sort of discuss and highlight about myself, because I do feel it's a really critical part of my evolution as a person.
Our last guest wants to remain anonymous, so I'm just going to call her by her initials, JC. And she says she was not admitted to her first choice, Harvard.
I'm Asian American. I'm an immigrant who came to the U.S. when I was in first grade. I grew up in a lower middle class household. My mom was a public school teacher. She scrimped and saved her way to move me into a tiny apartment in a wealthy school district, so at least I can go to a good school. I had a perfect SAT score, so a 1600 out of 1600. I did 2 summers of research at an Ivy League medical school. I was on the county math team. Despite all that, I got waitlisted from Harvard. Meanwhile, from my high school, there were 2 people who got in with much lower credentials who were athletes. Their SAT scores were respectively 1350 and 1360 versus my 1600. One of the 2 athletes was also a legacy. His dad and his older brother had both gone to Harvard. It was extremely disappointing to me to run into something that was so blatantly unequal and so blatantly unmeritocratic. And my goal now, in addition to my other plans to make the world a better place, is also to make sure this doesn't happen to anyone else again.
Bernita picked up the conversation on the point that JC last made about whether we should talk about athletes when we talk about race-based admissions.
I would like to pinpoint that I think conflating university admissions policies that prefer athletes with university admissions policies that take into account the racial background of a student is really problematic. Those are two separate kinds of discussions to be had. I mean, I can definitely understand why someone would have an issue with athletes being privileged over other students with higher test scores and things of that nature. I do think that conflating that with race-based admissions policies does a disservice to the discussion about affirmative action.
Diana, what are your thoughts? Because you mentioned you are a legacy student, and that may have played a role in your getting into Cornell. And the reason why we're including legacies in this conversation is because the majority of legacy students do happen to be white students.
It's definitely a tricky topic to discuss. I totally understand where JC is coming from. That is incredibly frustrating to have worked so hard, especially given your background and had the scores that you had, and to have not gotten into the top school of your choice. Like, I can totally see, and it's hard for me to say that I don't like the legacy system completely, because I do think it could have had something to do with me being admitted to my school, and I do like having that connection with my mom, who also went to the same school, but I can see how it would present an unfair bias towards more privileged families and skew admissions.
I just actually, before convening this roundtable with the three of you, I spoke to a former admissions counselor at University of Pennsylvania. And one thing that did come up and continues to come up is whether or not someone can take away a seat from somebody else. And JC, you seem to think that that happened to you.
I think if you think about what colleges are, the mission of a college is mostly education. Just like the mission of the World Cup is mostly soccer, and the mission of the Olympics is mostly sports, and the mission of making a movie is mostly acting or directing. For example, when I was like younger, you know, I had like a secret dream of being a movie star. But it's not my main thing I'm spending my time on. So I can't just go to Steven Spielberg and say, hey, you know, you should cast me your next blockbuster as the main lead role because I love to act and I bring intellectual diversity to the cast, right? That doesn't fly. And just likewise, school is mostly about academics. And so if you can't do a good job in school, why should you get into Harvard? That just sounds like it's just not very related to playing sports.
Well, and I also think that, you know, the big question I think that I'm trying to understand from the three of you is who is benefiting from these policies, particularly if we get rid of race-based affirmative action, which they've done in Michigan and they've done that in California. Is there a way to focus on class?
Yeah, I would just like to jump in and say that in this country, you cannot legitimately separate class from race. Race really determines your class background in large part in this country. I would also say that it is a reality in some respects that at elite universities, the people of color who are admitted are probably by and large from upper middle class backgrounds more so than lower middle class backgrounds. As I would say about any public policy, nothing is perfect and there's always room for improvement. I always like to point folks to an essay by one of my law professors, Professor Angela Onwuachi-Willick, who's now a dean at Boston University. But she has a couple of really interesting, I believe, proposed solutions to kind of get at this particular skewed sort of problem at the elite universities. And one solution was to sort of include as a requirement an essay where students from diverse backgrounds, they submit an essay about their racial background and ancestral heritage to the extent that they know it, and how that has helped shape their identity, whether they want that background to even be considered in the admissions process, how it can add to the diversity of the college environment. And she really suggests that this is a way to get at the university's intentions around diversity.
So yeah. We got one solution from Bernita. We're coming up on the end of our segment. I want to hear one solution from JC. And Diane, I'll give you a couple minutes to think about your proposed solution. Go ahead, JC.
So I have another solution. So when California got rid of affirmative action through Proposition, they came up with a better solution, I think. And what they did was they, I do realize that class and race are linked, But through a lot of class variables, you can also account for, you know, disadvantaged African-Americans, for example. Richard Sanders at UCLA Law School had a system where he looked at parents' income, parents' assets, because we know that African-Americans have much lower assets than white Americans due to histories of discrimination and so on. And you can look at other variables. And the sum effect of those variables was that UCLA was able to admit diversity people who were disadvantaged and who also really succeeded.
Diane, I want to hear from you.
I think something's got to give. I think the system itself has a lot of problems. I do think it kind of comes down to looking at students as an entirety when they're coming into colleges and kind of having perhaps the admissions process be a bit more complex. It's hard to do when you have such a high number of students applying at once. But I do think there has to be something else implemented, because even if we just take away kind of all programs and that kind of attempt to create more diverse college campuses and just have it based on merit, if just that merit is test scores alone and you just have the top test scores, I don't necessarily that's going to make for the most complex and interesting and diverse group of individuals at a given college.
I want to add something that I've sort of heard subtexts of both in this conversation and also by reading comments online. And it is this idea that Asian Americans are only good at taking tests and getting good grades and they're not good at anything else. And I think that's a highly problematic kind of stereotype.
I would agree with that as well. I think that's a very pernicious stereotype, and it definitely needs to be upended. I would completely agree.
And it sounds like a lot of what we've been discussing today is really rooted in stereotypes, right? And a lot of the issues that we face when it comes to affirmative action, unfortunately, continue to be complicated and very much connected to our difficult American history. Diana Brown is going into her senior year at Cornell. Bernita Haynes is a lawyer who graduated from Drury University in 2006 and the University of Iowa Law School in 2013. And JC graduated about 10 years ago from a top-tier university. I want to thank the three of you for having such a robust and interesting conversation about a difficult topic. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Desi Conrad, and I'm calling from Hartsville, South Carolina. I'm pretty sure I got into the college that I was aiming for because I was former Army. I'm a female, and I'm a Native American, so I ticked off lots of their diversification boxes.
Hi, this is Nicholas from Westfield, Massachusetts. I'm calling about acceptance into college. While my grades were certainly a factor, I knew that legacy certainly played a role in my acceptance as well. Though the one-on-one interview I had, along with an unusual essay choice, may have contributed to my acceptance too.
Tanzina Vega back here on The Takeaway, and I need to play you something from CNN over the weekend. Take a listen.
The document accuses you of being a, quote, agent of a foreign power. Were you?
Jake, this is so ridiculous. It's just beyond words. You know, it's you're talking about misleading the courts. It's just so misleading going through those 400-plus page documents.
That's Carter Page, former Trump campaign advisor, speaking with Jake Tapper on Sunday morning. Just a day earlier, the Justice Department released documents related to the government's surveillance of Page. And according to the documents, the FBI believed Page conspired with the Russian government. Shane Harris is an intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post, and he's helping us out with this today. Thanks for joining us, Shane.
Hi, it's nice to be with you.
So more than 400 pages in this document from October 2016. What's in the 400 pages, and where does Carter Page fit into all of this?
Well, a lot of what's in those pages is redacted. So, but what we do know is that what we can see is the FBI and the Justice Department's justification for why it thought back in October of 2016 and subsequent to that as well, that Carter Page was working as an agent on behalf of the Russian government. And this application, it's extraordinary and I think unprecedented to even see one of these applications for what's called a FISA warrant. They're never released. So what we're seeing here is basically the government very methodically trying to draw out for a judge all of the reasons why it thinks that Carter Page is this agent, and therefore they should be monitoring him under this special law that's reserved specifically for tracking spies and for tracking terrorists that are also Americans. So we really kind of get this insight in the fall of 2016 as the FBI is tracking this kind of expanding probe of Russians connected to the Trump campaign, what it thinks it knows about Carter Page, who was then an advisor to the Trump campaign.
Of course, the president over the weekend continues to call this investigation a witch hunt. President Trump tweeted on Sunday that the Justice Department and the FBI, and I'm quoting here, had misled the courts in the early stages of the investigation. Is there any proof of this?
No, and I think there may be actually negative proof of this based on as far as what the president and some Republicans in Congress have suggested, which is that the bulk of this FISA application consisted of the notorious dossier, the so-called Steele dossier. We can certainly see that there are references to information from that dossier and other sources, public sources, in the FISA application, but there's a whole section upon section that is blacked out. And traditionally, other forms of information would go into a warrant application like this, including potentially classified information that was gained from other sources. And we also see, importantly, in this application that the FBI did disclose to several judges who reviewed these applications that the information from the so-called Steele dossier was, in fact, political opposition research. Republicans in Congress had tried to claim that the government tried to deceive a judge into that and didn't say, hey, this information that we're giving you about Carter Page was generated for political partisan purposes. They did, in fact, disclose that. And they said that, nevertheless, we think that Christopher Steele, who generated the information in this report, a former British intelligence officer, was a longtime source to the American government and was reliable and trustworthy.
And at the same time, the FISA judges were Republican, and they approved Page's surveillance, right?
That's right. And that's, we should say, is not surprising either. FISA judges do, in fact, mostly approve surveillance orders. Now, critics of the process will say that shows that these judges are a rubber stamp. But people who I've talked to over the years who've worked in this process will say that's not quite right. What's actually happened is that government agents who fill out these applications know exactly what they have to do to meet the standard under law to be able to go ahead and get these orders. And I think it's fair to assume as well that the judges in this case would be applying even perhaps more than the already high level of scrutiny that they do because they knew this involved an aid to a campaign for president of the United States.
And we talked a little bit about the Republican reaction to this, but what about the Democrats? And where does Devin Nunes fall into all of this?
Well, the Democrats are saying, look, this blows apart the argument that the FISA of Carter Page was politically motivated or predicated solely on this, what Republicans see as a discredited dossier. Devin Nunes, the chairman of the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, has been the leading figure in Congress trying to discredit both the dossier, but also undermine the legitimacy of this FISA warrant on Carter Page. I don't think this is likely to stop that debate. Now you're seeing Republicans allied with Nunes even saying for the more portions of the document that was released to be unredacted so we can see what else there is. But Democrats really believe that this has proved their case and would like to just stop this argument that somehow the surveillance of this particular person was politically motivated.
And so, you know, this is just one part of many in the Russia investigation, if you will. Where do we go from here? Where does this document play in going forward?
I think both sides are going to use it to try and reinforce their positions, honestly. I mean, in trying to discredit the FISA on Carter Page, the Republicans and the president, and you see the president doing this, I mean, right now in his Twitter feed, are trying to say that this is somehow kind of the original sin or this kind of poisoned inception, if you will, of the entire Russia probe, which doesn't make a lot of sense because the probe itself actually predates by several months the surveillance of Carter Page. But nevertheless, now that you have this document out in the public, both sides, I think, are going to look at it and pull facts out of affidavit to support their argument. I do think that the Democrats in this case have the factually supported argument. There's a lot in the FISA application that really undermines or I think completely discredits what Republicans are saying. But underneath all of those blacked out lines where all those redactions are, you're still going to have people, I think, saying, well, we don't know what's under there. We don't know what this is. We need to find out more. And that will keep the fight going.
Always exciting for these updates. Thanks, Shane Harris, an intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Happy to be with you.
In Los Angeles, more than 40,000 people sleep in the streets each night. And compared to most major cities, L.A. has relatively few shelter beds. But years of mounting public outcry and pressure have forced the local government to act. Earlier this year, Mayor Eric Garcetti pledged to end homelessness by 2028.
Are you ready to house our homeless?
Yeah,
are you ready to see facilities in your neighborhood?
Yeah,
are you ready to end homelessness in Los Angeles?
Yeah,
but his plans aren't all well received. Here to talk about how Los Angeles is handling its massive homelessness crisis is Saul Gonzalez, a reporter for KCRW. Hey, Saul.
Hi.
So tell us what the homeless crisis looks like on the ground in L.A. What makes this crisis different?
Well, I'll put it simply. It looks really, really bad on the ground in Los Angeles. There are those huge numbers you referenced in your introduction, more than 50,000 people homeless in the greater Los Angeles area. And really, you know, more beyond that, though, it's just where the homeless people are. This used to be a problem that was confined in a lot of people's minds, mostly to Skid Row in the Central City area, a couple of other hot spots like Venice and Hollywood. But now it really is a citywide problem. I mean, just driving here into the studio to talk to you, I took surface streets, and I must have passed 8 or 9 homeless encampments that I don't remember being there a couple of years ago.
Now, you're saying encampments. You're not even talking about individual homeless people. You're talking about actual mini tent cities that have been put up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, picture a city block and picture a row of tents or sort of a cardboard lean-tos down that entire city block. And I'm just talking just off of, you know, major thoroughfares here in Los Angeles, like Wilshire and Olympic or Pico. And again, that is not something that you saw in this city or wasn't as visible a few years back.
So we mentioned at the top Mayor Garcetti talking about what his plans are to change this situation in L.A. Tell us a little bit about what you've seen so far.
Well, in the long term, really the gold standard here is to build a long-term supportive housing, right? That's to get people permanently off the streets and into shelters, and not only into shelters or into living units, but into places where they can get more help, like drug addiction counseling or help finding jobs. And there are 3 projects now under construction that are being built that will provide that supportive housing. There are about 29 projects in total. The idea is to get 10,000 people off the streets, about 1,000 people a year over 10 years. In the short term, though, the mayor has declared a crisis when it comes to homelessness, and he wants to site sort of a crisis homeless shelters across the city, 15 in all, that would take about 1,500 people at a time. And that is the short-term solution, to get people off the streets, people who are already there, by the way, and get them into portable housing or into tents, and also get them help at those locations. And we're talking places like city parking lots that could be converted into these crisis shelters.
And are we thinking that Mayor Garcetti might be hoping that this will come in time for a potential 2020 political bid?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that the mayor generally cares about this issue. He's been talking about homelessness for a while. But, you know, in the background is this possible presidential run. And I think the mayor knows that, you know, he cannot run for national office or for higher office without having, you know, somewhat remedied at least the homeless crisis here in Los Angeles.
Saul Gonzalez is a reporter for KCRW. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Saul.
Thank you.
Nearly 1/4 of America's homeless population lives in California. And just like in the rest of the nation, that population is aging. This year, there's been a 22% increase in the number of homeless people who are over the age of 62. And that demographic shift presents a new challenge for city officials. Mike Neely has been working with LA's homeless population for decades, and he now sits on the LA County Commission for Older Adults. Mike, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a sad story. Tell us a little bit about why we're seeing more elderly in the LA homeless population now.
Well, I think that there are several very important reasons why it's happening. I think number one is gentrification. I think number two is the fact that older adults, their income has been stagnant for many, many years. The other real problem happens to be that healthcare costs have risen and income has not kept up with those costs. So we've got almost a perfect storm for individuals being squeezed out of housing, especially when you've got a housing market that's as unaffordable as the Los Angeles market.
And are these folks, is the increase mostly in folks who are homeless finding themselves in this situation for the first time, or are these folks who continue to sort of circle in and out of homelessness?
I think that you have a number of people who have circled in and out of homelessness, but I think that a lot of the increase is presented by individuals who find themselves homeless for the first time. But I think that we're seeing a new increase simply because of the fact that we have not really and truly addressed the issue as we should have a long, long time ago.
Now, is the city aware of this increase? And if so, then what exactly are they doing to mitigate this?
I think that they've become aware of it. I think that the way that it's being addressed, because it's being addressed by the city as well as the county, I think that the county has asked the Board of Supervisors to really and truly begin to look at what we can do to deal with the older homeless population. There's supposed to be a report coming out on the 15th of August to the Board of Supervisors with a list of recommendations. However, I'm not sure if they're going to cover the full range of what is needed for older adults. One of the things I think is important is that we begin to look at specialized facilities to deal with some of the problems that older adults confront that other homeless populations don't.
Tell us a little bit about what some of those are.
Well, an older adult has mobility issues. An older adult has memory issues. An older adult has issues in terms of medication, dietary needs, increased needs to be able to get to health care, to see a doctor. There are just a number of things that older adults need that the other members of the homeless population may not need.
And in terms of the city shelters, are those shelters equipped to deal with an elderly population or an aging homeless population?
In most cases, no, because they have not really and truly taken into account all of the factors that we just talked about relative to older adults. And the other thing about it is that for an older adult, one of the real problems that have to be overcome is the fear factor in terms of going into a mass shelter with individuals who are younger, stronger, and who may or may not take advantage of older adults.
Is there anything on the horizon that could be positive for this community?
Well, I think that by raising the level of awareness, that is the first step into solution to any problem. I believe that there's enough stuff out there for us to be able to forge a solution for the frail, for the elderly, for individuals that really and truly are most vulnerable in our population and that need our help probably more than anyone else.
Mike Neely sits on the Los Angeles County Commission for Older Adults. Mike, thanks for talking with me about this today.
Thank you so very much.
Calm down, dear. Calm down. Calm down.
You calm down for a second?
Calm down. I'll get back to your seat.
She was warned. She was given an explanation.
I don't give a damn about my reputation.
Nevertheless, she persisted.
Living in the past, new generation.
I want you to know that I am more offended as an African-American woman than you will ever be. And don't talk to me about the fact that we don't understand what happens on the automobile. No, I will not yield.
I hear you were terrorizing Mr. Morgan's class again. People perceive you as somewhat
tempestuous.
You might want to work on that.
Never said I wanted to move my station.
Hysterical, shrill, crazy, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. These are just some of the ways we describe women when they get angry. And there are, of course, worse ways. Why do we belittle, fear, or just plain dismiss a woman's rage? What are the consequences of doing so? All this week on The Takeaway, we've got a new series we're calling Hysterical: Women and Rage, looking at exactly why angry women are often treated differently than angry men. And to kick things off, we've assembled a roundtable of women who are experts on the topic. Soraya Shamali, her forthcoming book is called Rage Becomes Her. Writer and actor Mara Wilson wrote a piece for Elle this spring called What If Girls Knew They Were Allowed to Be Angry? And Brittany Cooper recently wrote a book called Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower.
Many women struggle with the way that being called angry women means that you're treated as though you're being irrational. So there's a way in which anger is feminized as an illogical response. And then we get to the angry black woman stereotype, where you're seen as rash, brash, untrustworthy, frankly, dangerous, volatile. So there is a way that we are conditioned, particularly as women, also as people of color, to distrust anger, to see it as a destructive force, and to really suppress it for fear that we won't be taken seriously in our work and even in our politics.
And Mara, you wrote a piece about essentially learning to when you were allowed or not allowed to be angry. When did you realize that anger for you was perceived as a bad thing?
I think I learned it at a very young age. My mother was somebody who could feel a lot of anger, and I think she used it in really righteous ways. She tried to advocate for justice in our community all the time, and I saw that, but I feel like I felt a little uneasy with my own anger because while I could see that my mother could channel it in this constructive way, I saw people seemed scared or confused, or they just thought that it was odd that I was angry. I think girls are socialized to, I think that they aren't expected to be angry. They can have other emotions to some degree, but they cannot be angry. I think with boys, I think it's the opposite, that they are only expected to be angry and not to show any other emotions.
Soraya, where do you think we, or why are women sort of grappling with the, or maybe not just women, but why are we as a society grappling with the idea that anger is illegitimate for us to experience?
Well, we know that biases, parental biases, so very early on in the home, before kids even get to school, predispose people to attribute sadness to infants that are girls when they're agitated, but anger to boys, and to encourage girls to use their quote-unquote nice voices 3 to 4 times as often as they do boys. And Mara really hit it on the head when she said that girls are taught about a whole range of emotions and of emotionality in general, but distinctly not talked to about anger, whereas boys are left bereft of much more robust understandings of their emotions, but specifically talked to about anger.
One of the things I'm thinking as I'm listening to Soraya is that in some ways, we simply need an argument for a better model around anger. Mm-hmm. So for me, part of the reason that I feared my anger wasn't so much about what other people said, but about the fact that I had seen destructive anger in my own family. I had seen my father's anger and the way that it created chaos. And so coming to have like a gendered analysis of that and understanding that in many ways, that is the way that men use anger to assert power, and that so much of our scripts around anger come from toxic masculinity, and recognizing that if you actually look, it's not to say that women are pure users of anger, but to say that we have a better track record, that our anger typically empowers or powers a response to injustice.
Mara, I'm curious too about right when you wrote this piece, we were talking about race and anger here. As a white woman, do you feel that you're allowed in some implicit or explicit ways to express frustration, anger, and rage more than perhaps women of color? Or do you not see any distinctions?
I do think that we are. I do think that we are. We tend to be forgiven more for transgressions, for saying things, you know. The things that I heard a lot were things like, boys don't like that. Don't be angry, boys don't like that. But I think that what I have seen and heard from women of color is that these girls are not allowed to be children. They're not allowed to be girls. They're not allowed to be angry. There's so much that they're just not allowed to be.
You know, I've been thinking about this because, you know, we've had this rash of white women calling the police on black folks and brown folks.
Yeah.
And so, Mar, you make this really good point about white femininity and the like limitations of white femininity, all the things that white women are not allowed to do. And so it's interesting because it's like white women have lots of rage. Some of it is righteous, but some of it is deeply racist and classist, frankly. And so then what happens is that they're using the police to sort of come in and do the work of the destructive work of white female anger. Police state violence is a masculinist form of violence. And so part of the problem is also that white femininity often colludes on behalf of rage. So they won't enact violence themselves, but they will at strategic moments call in the masculine reinforcers in the name of the police. And so it's a really interesting race gender dynamic. And I think we've talked a lot in the media about it as a racial issue, but it's also a gender issue. It's a way that white women know that they can sort of use the distress call of what I like to call in my book, white girl tears, to sort of enact violence on people of color without having to be accountable for it.
Soraya, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think it's really interesting because to me, each of these incidents is a microcosm of what happened during the election, because the white women voters who supported Donald Trump's campaign were supporting a toxic white male supremacist border mentality, right? A lot of the time, because white women benefit from white supremacy, there's a lack of understanding maybe of sometimes what is extreme gender inequality, particularly in the home or in religious institutions. And faced with examples of gender inequality, people tend to double down. I want these rules. I want these lines. I can play off of this sense of my own innocence and vulnerability to call in the police. And that's all to me, you know, one example after another of what we see writ large in the political system.
It infuriates me when the requirement is that you perform some traditionally feminine mm-hmm. role in order to be perceived as legitimate. You know, I have been saying more recently, part of the problem here is not that anger is a feeling, but rather that when you are white or male, your feelings get treated as facts. And when you are female or black or brown, your facts get treated as mere feelings, as mere emotions that we can't, you know, tie to any level of reality.
Mara, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that I have seen a lot of women struggle with their anger in a way, and what ends up happening is they end up taking it out on other women. I think that they feel powerless, they feel frustrated, and, you know, there is this idea of where is it going to go? And it can hurt themselves and it can hurt other women, too. It's when they are in this frustrated place that they will end up doing that, and I think that that's a serious danger. We talk about the fact that, you know, girls are mean to each other, but we never talk about why, I think. And that is something that I have been thinking about since I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I saw this sort of misplaced anger go there. And that is something that I think is a dangerous thing.
Well, and there's also the sort of going back to the idea that, you know, women essentially today are saying, you know what, I'm angry and here it is. I'd love for us to wrap with thinking, how do we as women more broadly begin to do that? Do we need advice? Do we need permission? Or do we just own it and say, you know what? I'm rageful, I'm angry, and it's really your problem, not mine.
So this is Soraya. Yes, I would say that that's a good first start, but I think that's really hard for people. I think for me, one of the important things to do, particularly I think for young women and girls, is to be comfortable with discomfort, be comfortable yes. with not pleasing people, which is a mandate for us, right? We're supposed to care for people and make people around us happy and comfortable, and understand that you will cause discomfort in the people around you, but that's all right, because actually in the discomfort can come more intimacy, better communication, a fairer, more equitable relationship or society. But getting comfortable with discomfort is, I think, very necessary for the whole society.
Mara?
Yes, I think that also we need to think about how we acknowledge anger. I think that there's a lot of, oh, well, you're just angry, you're being illogical, you're being, or anger in women is ridiculed. And I think that one of the most important things you can do is when somebody is angry, you can acknowledge that they're angry. It is uncomfortable, but I think, as Soraya says, it's a discomfort that we need to learn to live with.
Yeah, you know, I actually want to put a call out to parents to say, make space for your children's anger, to model for them safe ways that their anger can be a part of their lives and doesn't have to be destructive. I don't think you should let your children slam doors in your house, but you can let them walk away and feel their feelings and give them some parameters. I feel like even just that little shift, and my mother is my hero, but that little shift might have given me the space as a kid to have a healthier relationship to my anger much earlier. And also, yes, be unapologetic. If you're a grown person, be unapologetic. You have the right to your anger. What you don't have the right to do is destroy anything, but you absolutely have the right to use that energy as a superpower.
Brittany, Soraya, Mara, thank you so much. Appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts and your insights on this really important topic.
Thank you very much for bringing us all together.
Mara Wilson is a writer and actor, and you can subscribe to her newsletter on Substack. Soraya Shamali is the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project, and her forthcoming book is called Rage Becomes Her. And Brittany Cooper is the author of Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. And all this week, as a bonus, we've asked every guest for a song by a woman that they like to rage to. Here's Brittany Cooper's. To hear Soraya and Mara's songs and some picks from the Takeaway staff, head to our website, thetakeaway.org. We've linked to a Spotify playlist. And let us know what your favorite song by a woman or women is to rage to. Tweet us at The Takeaway and we'll add it to the list. And a note to parents, when you're singing about rage, it might be hard to keep your language in check, so you might want to take a peek at the playlist before you hit play. And we're going to be talking about this topic all week. So ladies, tell us, do you feel like you can show anger in your personal life or your professional life? What happened the last time you did? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we might include your story on the show this week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.